Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is Wednesday, July 5th, 2017. It was July 4th yesterday. Well, Syria, it's a complete mess, and there are many competing interests, and today we're going to dive in and unravel as much as we can. It's important because the potential exists for a misstep in Syria that leads to a direct conflict militarily between Russia and the United States. Today, we're going to be talking with a gentleman who is known online as The Saker. His background includes intelligence work, and we'll let him tell us what he can at this time about his background. I know that his family comes from Russia, and he spent many years professionally analyzing Russia and a decade looking into Hezbollah. Given that background, his writings on Syria are analytically rooted in a deep understanding, and his writings are really, they're very widely read. I read them all the time. His website is thesaker.is. As I said, I read it religiously for an alternative view, or maybe even a more complete view, on events in Ukraine and now Syria. I find it full of information and providing vastly more context than can be found in mainstream sources, especially in the U.S. and Europe. Welcome, Saker. Hey, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's absolutely a pleasure. I very much look forward to our conversation.
Well, as a way of starting, Saker, what should we know about your background and how that relates to your writings on Russia and Syria?
Well, I think you covered it pretty well. I was born in a family of Russian refugees in Switzerland. So born in Europe, got most of my education actually in the United States. So studied military topics and strategy in the U.S. And I used to be a Cold Warrior, which means I studied the Soviet Union as the enemy, which actually gives me also somewhat of an insight, of course, into what's happening today in Russia and the Ukraine. And right now I'm just a blogger and I don't write any classified stuff anymore. So it's actually a joy for me to be able to write what I want with nobody looking over my shoulder in terms of contents.
Yeah, that is a blessing. So let's turn now to Syria. How did that conflict get started? How far back do we have to unravel this to really understand what's happening today?
Oh, we could go very far. I think the key thing to summarize it, there were truly grievances with the regime in power in Syria. It began with the father of the current president, who was a very who ruled with a very strict rule. And most Syrians, I knew a lot of them during my time of studies, they would honestly tell you that they had a secret police, the Mukhabarat, as they call it, one of them, that he was, you know, very authoritarian, brutal in many ways, but also prosperous, well-organized. I mean, it was a typical Ba'athist, secular, nationalist Arab regime who had, as one of its characteristics, of course, stance against Israel. And I think what happened was similar to what happened in many other countries. The U.S. identified, there was, of course, a U.S. plan to destabilize all the secular Arab countries, starting with, the Northern Africa, and then it went further. And, of course, the U.S. overthrew, Hussein in Iraq. Something similar happened here. There was a discontent. There was a potential. The new president paradoxically was democratizing and sort of trying to reform his country, which in a way made it weaker, more susceptible to subversion. And Western intelligence agencies very skillfully injected into that conflict what I call Daesh as a global, but we can call it Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Islamic State. It doesn't really matter what label you put on it. But that Wahhabi or Takfiri is another term for that extremist element was injected in there. And gradually, first of all, they brought money, they brought weapons, and they brought violence. And the government predictably reacted with a crackdown, which didn't go well. And that basically how the entire region exploded. Oh, I shouldn't say the region, the country exploded. The region had already been affected by the war in Iraq, of course, where a lot of elements came from Iraq into Syria, but they also came from all over the world. Really, the United States federated Initially, if you look at the origins of Al-Qaeda, it was not even a movement. It was a small group of people in the deserts of Saudi Arabia. The Wahhabis basically had extremist Islamic ideology. What the U.S. did, they federated them to use them the first time against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And then the same forces were used in Bosnia, they were used in Chechnya, they were used in Kosovo, and then they were, for the first time, they were injected into Arab, Muslim, but secular countries, such as Libya. And it's been going on ever since.
Now, so in these competing interests, one view says that, okay, so this is really a proxy Shia-Sunni war. Of course, there's another view that says this is really Israel looking to create a lot of destabilized, ineffective countries around it as a means of providing security for itself. The United States is doing something. Can you help me understand what the United States strategy here? I've been a little lost as to what the overarching strategy really was, unless it was to break things. So what happened in Libya, for instance, with Muammar Gaddafi basically elevating his country from almost dead last on the world ranking list to a very, very high standard of living with lots of different tribes that he had to balance out. So, of course, that's tricky business and he had to use what methods he could. But that was a really prosperous country. They had no Western banks in there. They had a nationalized oil company. If you got married, you had a one-time endowment, I guess, from the government of $49,500.
Yep.
They would pay for people to travel anywhere in the world to get medical care if they couldn't provide it at home. All mortgages were slated at 10% of your salary for 20 years from the government. On and on. Big, big, big stuff. Now it's a giant mess. The story was always that we were there to help bring democracy. Obviously, that didn't happen. What's the U.S. strategy here? Can you help me understand it?
Well, can try. First of all, I should say as a preamble that I'm not at all convinced that there is a U.S. strategy. I think there is a CIA strategy, a Pentagon strategy, a State Department strategy. There used to be a White House strategy. Right now, I'm not even sure. And even we should go deeper inside who is doing what inside the Pentagon and the military. I mean, there is chaos. There has been chaos since Obama, because he was an extremely weak president. So when a superpower like the United States is ruled by a more or less absent man in the White House, the agencies start themselves implementing their own policies. And this is continuing now with Trump, who was elected on a specific platform and now has basically given it up. There's been a coup against him by the neocons who basically got him under control. He wanted to drain the swamp, and the swamp basically drowned him. So I'm not sure there is anything I could identify as a U.S. policy. There is, however, an Israeli and a Saudi policy. And those two happen to be very, very closely aligned, because those two, first of all, are extremely powerful lobbies, as we well know, inside the United States. But not only inside the United States, they're objectively key allies in the region, which is very counterintuitive. You would think, what would the Saudi Wahhabis have in common with, the Israelis? Well, they do. And what they have in common is an immense fear of Iran, first and foremost. And generally, the Saudis and the Israelis have the same exact interest for the Arab Muslim world, which is to keep it in chaos and weak. That allows them to rule it. It's that simple. So what happens in Syria is that Israel is being very back, it keeps a very low profile. The Saudis are obviously much more vocal about it, but essentially work hand in glove together. And the threat, you mentioned the Shia Sunni opposition. I think it's true. I think there's actually what I call an anti-Shia crusade, which could not be waged by secular Sunni governments. You could not recruit. Saddam Hussein had his tried at going against Iran, and it didn't work well. So what was needed is to have the real, the Wahhabi crazies, because they're willing to go definitely against anything that's Shia, be it in Bahrain, be it in Syria, in Iraq, or even the prize, the real prize is Iran, because Iran represents a huge threat for Israel, the U.S., and the Saudi Arabia. And the threat is not that invented, fairy tale about the Iranians developing nuclear weapon. That's absolutely ridiculous. There's no basis to that whatsoever. However, Iran is a Shia Muslim traditionalist, yet in many aspects, I would say progressive society. which in spite of extremely difficult, in spite of sanctions, in spite of subversion, in spite of many problems, is actually prospering. And there is what I call the gravitational pull of the Iranian example. And, you know, first it was only for the Shia. We all know that Hezbollah was very closely linked to Iran. And then, you know, the other Shia in the Middle East start looking towards Iran as the example. But the real, we now really see the terror, the worst scenario now actually materializing, which is what's happening with Qatar, which is not a Shia country, but is feeling the pull because they have a gas field in common and Iran has a lot to offer. So even the fact that the Qataris would just generally kind of look at Iran with anything but a bellicose and hostile look is perceived by Saudi Arabia as quasi-declaration of war. So we see how sensitive they are about that. So it's basically a union of the West, what I call the Anglo-Zionist Empire, but with a very strong element of Wahhabi takfirism. And all of them, of course, this is a proxy war, definitely. For instance, if, as the United States had tried to achieve, if, let's call them Daesh, had come to power in Damascus and the regime would have fallen, the very next thing that would have happened would have been obviously an infiltration into Lebanon going after Hezbollah. So you see how clearly it is. The Israelis tried to beat Hezbollah in 2006. They got very, very humiliated. I mean, they really lost one of the worst defeats that I can think of during the Lebanese called the Divine Victory, where they defeated the powers of Israel. And they're not willing, the Israelis are just not willing to repeat that. So instead, what they wanted to do is to use the Takfiris, the Al-Qaeda, if you want to call them, to, from Syria, the next step would have been clearly first of all, Lebanon and Hezbollah, and then Iraq, which is also threatened by them now. Because essentially by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, the United States almost, I would say, handed over Iraq to Iran, which became the main actor there, certainly the most powerful one. And now they have second thoughts about that because it's very bad. Iran grew in power and influence as a result of that war. So now they're trying to chase away the regime there by supporting Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So it's all a domino ripple effect. But the real core of it is always will be Iran as the main threat to everybody there.
Now let's turn for a second to some of the details in there. You know, it was probably 3 years ago, I'm going to guess at this point, where I first started to write about Syria a little bit. And I came across a picture of the so-called, I guess what are being called the Syrian Democratic Forces. And I couldn't find a Syrian in the picture. There was a very prominent Chechen in there. There was a bunch of North Africans. There were clearly a few Pakistanis and some Afghanis. I couldn't find a Syrian in the picture. Clearly mercenaries, something I think people in my country, the United States in particular, don't appreciate, which is that if all of a sudden you had people from all sorts of neighboring countries showing up in, say, New Jersey, creating a lot of trouble and killing a lot of people and doing the things that Daesh did and does, those jihadists, very awful, so women, children, prisoners, mm-hmm. you name it. And so when we look at that, my first question is, they're mercenaries, unless they're really just there, I guess, on some holy war. But if they're not, they're being paid. Who's paying them?
Oh, the Gulf countries and the United States. There's a mix there. You have a mix of poorly trained, very, you know, illiterate, basically, cannon fodder. Then you have a lot of very skillful and well-trained Sunni officers from Iraq who the former army of Saddam Hussein, who provide technical expertise. But you also have Western special forces. You have the Israelis sending material there and regularly providing air cover. You have all sorts of private companies were involved. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made there. And since a lot of people wanted Syria to be destabilized, I mean, I would say every single neighbor. I mean, Turkey certainly is also very guilty. Now they changed their tune somewhat, but initially they played a very important role. Turkey now is trying to say, you know, we're anti-terrorist, but they used to support the very same people in Syria. They certainly supported them in Chechnya and in Bosnia. So Turkey was an actor there. So everybody, I mean, the Syrians were absolutely left alone. Had it not been for, first of all, an immense effort by Hezbollah, who knew that they would be next. So they had to move. I mean, they moved under the exact same rationale as the Russians did. The Russians, when they went in, Vladimir Putin was very clear. He said, we fight them there, so we don't have to fight them here. And I'm not sure if Hassan Nasrallah said the same, you know, words, but essentially his message, his speeches were clear. We have to go there, you know, not only to help our Syrian brethren, but also because Lebanon is going to be next. And there have been small groups, I would say, little, you know, starting fires of Al-Qaeda types in Lebanon, in certain refugee camps, et cetera. Hezbollah took care of that pretty fast, but the risk is absolutely real for Lebanon. Lebanon and Syria are very similar. It's essentially the same country. So they know very well how much a danger they are. So everybody pitched in with money. There was tons of money. There was also gas contracts that were supposed to be passed. Oman is involved in that. I mean, there's huge amount of money because Syria is a strategic location. It's the, I would say, the cornerstone of the entire Middle East.
Well, a lot depends at this point on how the U.S. responds and what it does. Obviously, there's a lot of other competing interests that could move the needle. But I want to turn to something you recently wrote. I loved how these few sentences came together. So, quote, "First, we should all stop kidding ourselves. Russia and the USA do not have disagreements. The sad and frightening reality is that we are now closer to war than during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Not only are Russian and U.S. servicemen now deployed in the same war zone, the Americans totally illegally, but unlike what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we have a U.S. president who terminally lacks the willpower to deal with the crazies on the U.S. side. I am talking about the neocons, of course," end quote. So, you know, Saker, I actually had hopes during the election that Trump would be very different towards Russia. He made a lot of very different sounds about Russia than Hillary did. But now I don't see any particular difference at all between what I suspect Clinton would have been doing and what Trump is doing. What are your views here?
Well, first of all, just like you, when Trump ran for the first time in my life, I actually had hopes for U.S. presidents. I really did. And I think I have no apologies about that. Some people can criticize us for having supported Trump. The thing is, at that time, we could judge him only by his words. And his words were very, very good. Let's be honest. He said the right stuff. I had high hopes. I had hopes that he would not only meet with Putin for, you know, a short meeting on the sidelines of a G20 summit, but I was hoping of a Camp David kind of thing, where they would sit down with their key advisors and solve, because all the problems between Russia and the United States objectively are solvable. The solution are obvious. There's nothing complicated here. The only thing preventing that is ideology, from the neocons specifically. So I had high hopes for him, but unfortunately, and I think he was sincere. I know that some people say, well, he's been a plant all along. You know, I'm not a mind reader. I don't know what happened in his head, but I thought he was sincere. I thought they just broke him. I think he lacked courage. I think he lacked principles. The way he ditched Flynn showed that he couldn't even stand for his own friends, and I think they just absolutely, you know, flattened him. And now we have, yes, you're right, we have a Clinton-like, or I would say, Hillary was probably even worse, so I wouldn't say it's the same. It's still better than Hillary because we probably would have had some kind of shooting war with Russia over Syria, at least, had she been in power. I think I still hope that he can stop that. But I think we sort of have an Obama 2.0, where I don't discern a real policy there, and I see no prospects for him collaborating with Russia in a meaningful way. I mean, the perfect example for me is the missile strike. You know, we all knew then, but now it's been confirmed by Cy Hirsch that, you know, there was no missile, the chemical attack by the government. And what does he do? He doesn't even wait or do anything. He bombs the base first. Then the International Organization for the Control of Chemical Weapons, I think it's called, declares that there have been chemicals used there. They weren't on this plot. They didn't take samples, not in the place where it happened, not in the air base, you know, where supposedly the aircraft flew from, you know, and on the airbase, it was clear there was no chemicals because people were walking around in normal battle fatigues, which you wouldn't do if there was sarin gas there. I mean, all of it is just ridiculous. It would be funny if it wasn't tragic, to be honest. And right now, I don't see how Trump could do anything because by doing that, he alienated the Russians completely. And now he's basically in a position where anything he does that even remotely would be looking like he's working with the Russians will be interpreted by the Trump-hating media in the United States as a betrayal, as him being Putin's puppet, etc. We've seen it already. The people who demonstrated in front of the Trump towers, you know, handing him a one-way Aeroflot ticket to Moscow. I mean, for him, any deal with Russia would mean a major problem internally. And he's too weak to do that. So I don't see how he could possibly collaborate. Which means that I don't think the United States can do much in Syria. As a matter of fact, also on pragmatic grounds, Syria can only be resolved with boots on the ground. You need to control territory. You can't do that from the air. Well, look who has boots on the ground. The Syrians are one kind of boot on the ground. Hezbollah, for sure. A small boot on the ground, but a powerful one, would be Russia, and only in certain places for specific actions of the Turks and the Kurds. That's it. The Kurds are kind of paralyzed because the U.S. can't decide if they're going with the Kurds or with the Turks. The U.S. does not work with the Syrians or, God forbid, Hezbollah, which just leaves the only boots on the ground that the U.S. could possibly use is Al-Qaeda, which officially they don't want to use because officially they're there to fight them. I mean, it's ridiculous. I know it sounds totally surreal, but it's a sad truth. I don't think that Trump has any options in Syria. The only option for him would have been to work with the Russians, and he totally is unable to do that.
Now, you were talking earlier of the April 4th so-called gas attack that led to that April 6th Tomahawk missile strike, not the original so-called sarin gas attack, which Cy Hirsch also dismantled that one. That was back when Russia first got involved. Obama was president.
Correct.
And they were looking, and Syria coughed up its chemical weapon stockpiles. It was at least, as far as I understand, a reasonably well-conducted operation. There were lots of observers there. You had the UN, you had people were in there, right? So that was mm-hmm. one. And then we had this clearly the evidence of the April 4th attack, such as it is, because as you say, we didn't have independent people in taking samples, but none of the data fit. But still, you had Trump launching off that Tomahawk missile strike. And now Trump has drawn a red line around any future gas attacks with that posting on the White House press statement that said, that if there's any new future gas attack in Syria, that's going to lead to a heavy military response. What are the chances, do you think, that a gas attack will happen, and who would gain the most?
Well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, what happened yesterday, I don't think it's been reported much because it doesn't have much credibility, but I think there was an attempt to make it happen yesterday or the day before. I mean, I just saw it with one eye. I didn't have the time to look into a detail. I think that one deflated fast because the Russians immediately said, the spokesman for Russia, Zakharova, for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, warned about, said they're about to do it, and they accused Americans of basically almost declaring a false flag in order to justify an intervention. Some people who are optimistic said that the White House leaked that deliberately to prevent the Pentagon from doing that. I don't know. I don't know what's happening on that level. All I can tell you is, had there been an American response, I just question, what would it be? I mean, you could shoot a bunch of cruise missiles, and then what? I mean, the only people who would benefit from that, and even marginally, would be really the good terrorists. Because, first of all, we know that they're the ones who have the chemical weapons. I mean, the government has been disarmed. The U.S. and Russia both signed off on that. The organization who disarmed them, I think, even got a prize for that. So it was very official and controlled, and nobody complained. So I don't see any reason to believe that the Syrians kept any. And if they had kept any, I don't think they would have ever used them. I mean, that would be just suicidal. What does the government of Syria gain by using chemical weapons, which are not very effective? At least if that's what they've been doing, they've not been effective weapons attack. Chemical weapons are tricky to use to begin with. That's why we don't see them in real military engagements. One of the reasons, they're tricky to use. But secondly, what, does the regime just want to be bombed? I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. So I think what we're hearing, you're asking, what's the rationale? And I'm not sure there's much of a rationale besides, you know, to somebody with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The U.S. is doing what it's good at doing, which is, you know, false flags, condemnations, threats, warning, red lines, and missile strikes. But unfortunately, unfortunately for the U.S., in a country like Syria, that's absolutely not enough. I don't think it would have achieved much. And I don't see the U.S. starting a meaningful operation on the ground. Because if they started a military operation on the ground, believe me, there would be lines in Beirut of Hezbollah fighters going, actually fighting American soldiers. I mean, they would be fighting each other to get to the front line first. And you don't want that. Believe me, the Americans don't want to try out Hezbollah from up close. So I don't think they're going to do that.
All right. Well, you wrote a really excellent piece on the actual capabilities of Russia as compared to the U.S. in the region of Syria. And so to sort of square that off, maybe ask this question, wouldn't Russia really face huge difficulties in going up against a vastly larger U.S. and NATO force if it came to that?
Yes, Russia would face huge difficulty. Russia had always said that from the day the rumor started that there would be a massive Russian intervention in Syria, I always said, absolutely not, this is not happening. The Russians are not coming. They send a very small force there, and that force is protected. Now, granted, it's well protected. Russia has some very advanced air defense systems protecting Russian forces and the Russian task force in Syria. But still, I mean, essentially, the number of aircraft that Russia has is limited. They're very advanced aircraft, but they're small in numbers, relatively small force on the ground. Yes, of course, the U.S. has Syria is essentially squeezed like a sandwich between CENTCOM and NATO. So the U.S. has much larger forces. But the trick is, the U.S. has only larger forces in the air. The U.S. has that limit. It cannot have, it does not have boots on the ground. Russia doesn't have either. I mean, very little contingent. But there are the Iranians who are present there who play an extremely important role, and they have boots on the ground. The Syrians have boots on the ground, and so does Hezbollah. So the combination of Iran, the Syrian forces, and Hezbollah on the ground, and Russians in the air, is very substantial. Secondly, if the United States decided to declare a no-fly zone over Russia or over Syria and got involved in a serious way, in, you know, sustained air operations, and would try to provide basically air cover and do for Al-Qaeda what they did for the Kosovars in Kosovo, the Russian response wouldn't be as much sending fighters in the air as it would be shooting with air defense missiles. And most people are focused on the very, very advanced long range, the so-called S-400s, which are extremely capable indeed. But there's another system which is less known called the Panzer, which is a shorter range, but it's a mixture of guns and missiles, and the Syrians have them, and the Russians have them too, and even the Iranians have them. And nobody knows, these are mobile missiles, systems, the entire system is actually mobile. Nobody knows exactly where they are, and they can take their targeting data from other sources. Those would present a real danger, because basically what it means in simple terms, the United States would never know when, at which point, an advanced missile would be flying towards American aircraft. And I think that if the decision was taken to shoot back, and I think it would be taken, the United States would start having, they wouldn't lose control of the airspace. It's not like they would be challenged by Russian MiGs in the air, but it would be a steady and very painful loss of aircraft day after day after day. Which will require what? Escalation? What's the next thing you do? You don't have boots on the ground. I think that's the real problem with the United States, is that to impose a no-fly zone, you need to suppress enemy air defenses. They can't do that. I don't believe they have the resources to do that. If they can't, that means they're going to take losses. If they take losses, they have to double down. How do you double down? You can't. That's what I think keeps them, basically has prevented the attack from happening so far. But absolutely, yes, the United States is a much more powerful. The capabilities of NATO and CENTCOM are immeasurably bigger than anything Russia has in the region.
Now, I've always been taken, and you know, we don't know how any of this would truly play out because we haven't seen it live tested yet, but I've been really taken by the videos I can get my hands on showing the latest in Russian missile technology. So where the United States was spending hundreds of billions a year camping out in foreign countries, numbering in the hundreds, and really spending that way, Russia seemed to have taken a 20-year detour into missile technology with such things as vectored thrusts, so you don't have to use fins, meaning you can really take some super high-G crazy turns at the end if you want to defeat an anti-missile technology that's there on a ship or otherwise. What's your assessment of you know, that idea that the Russians are strong and might be weak in numbers but strong in missiles, and how painful could that be for somebody like the U.S. with really astonishing capabilities militarily?
American capabilities are all centered on offensive operations. That's why the Americans were never that interested in air defense systems. They had the Patriots, they had other systems. Mostly the big thing, the American way of war, is what we saw against Iraq, which is, you know, missile and air attacks. The Russians were always very obsessed with defense. And so even in the Soviet times, they developed amazing air defense systems. Russian air defense systems are by far the most sophisticated of any air defense networks on the planet, including the American ones, which are much simpler. And it's not as much that they have some kind of very advanced technologies, but you're correct. They do, the way they integrate them together into a weapon system is very impressive. So they, you know, there were LEERs in passive and active phased array radars and thrust vectoring. They have extremely advanced electronic warfare systems. I personally explained the fact that about half of the missiles never, or more than half, never made it to that airbase during the missile strike. I think the Russians' electronic warfare systems took down these cruise missiles. So the losses would be very real. The U.S. is not really equipped to suppress Russian air defenses. The typical way the Americans would do that would be to send in stealth aircraft. Problem is that the Russians have very good radars that actually, so-called stealth craft are just less visible, but they're not invisible. It depends on the frequency that you start, looking for them with. They would use missiles which are designed to destroy radars, but Russian missiles have a longer range than these, so they couldn't get in range. The missiles are called HARMS. Those missiles wouldn't get in range. They would try to use electronic suppression by using jammers, et cetera, but the risk there is that Russian systems have what's called a home on jam mode. So really, the United States has never put the effort and the money and the technology and the training into fighting the kind of advanced air defense system that Russia never exported. That they kept the Soviets kept them for themselves. And even now, the Russians are reluctant. There have been some substantial exports, but it's not. The U.S. was just unlikely to see that level of sophistication. Syria is really a qualitative change. The Russians put down there basically the best of what they have, and they're running that themselves. So these are not export models. They are the real thing. And I don't think the United States, even if they have very large numbers, have enough to suppress that without very painful losses.
You know, as a quick aside, I noted that the cycle of ratcheting up the tension with Iran has gone through a few loops, but it seemed maybe not coincidental, maybe that last time the United States was really undergoing this big cycle. This was under Obama, you know, it was like centrifuges this, bombs almost any moment that, and we were really going to town. And then Russia supplied Iran with the S-300 system, and everything just sort of went quiet. And the way I read that was that all of a sudden, if we were going to do anything against Iran, it would be an air campaign. And the S-300 system really seemed to take the stuffing out of the turkey in this case, where at least that's how I interpreted it at the time. But I do get the sense from other people I've talked to in the military that there's a lot of respect, if not fear, about that, even just the S-300 system, let alone the S-400.
Yes, there is. But maybe I'm mistaken here, so don't take that to the bank. But I thought the deal with Iran was passed first, and then the Russians delivered the 300 to the Iranians. But maybe I'm wrong here. So it might be that they didn't have enough coffee this morning. So be careful with what I said here. About the Turks, well, remember the only Turkish aircraft shot down over Syria was by the Spencer system, by the cannons. So there was already a deterrence there. But definitely, I mean, the 400s were put down almost the day after by Putin as a message to the Turks, and he challenged them. He said, try flying now. The 300s actually come in a very many variant. The system itself, it's pretty old, has been upgraded many times. So it really depends on what kind of 300s you're looking at or the 400. The kind of 300s and 400s that the Russians have in Syria are the latest generation. So in terms of software, hardware, they're the latest of the latest, and they're extreme. They are the most formidable weapon systems, air defense systems that are out there, absolutely. They have one limitation, sheer numbers. I mean, you know, a battery will have that number of missiles. After that, you can reload. I mean, but really, the big weakness here would be the numbers of missiles that they could allocate to defend. They couldn't do it forever, and to resupply them would be dangerous and difficult for the Russians. That's why I tend to personally, I agree that's the big guy, it looks at all, it's the most frightening one. But the smaller one, the intermediate range, short to intermediate range, the Panzer S1, they're there in bigger numbers, and to resupply them and preposition these missiles, which are smaller in size, is easier. And those also represent a very, very sophisticated threat. Maybe not as long range, as scary by the numbers as the 300 or 400s, but definitely one that the pilot sitting in the cockpit would have to think of very hard and constantly while over Syrian airspace.
So you mentioned an important word, Saker, earlier, which was escalation. So just wargaming this out, let's assume some of this starts to happen. United States is losing a few planes. That causes some kind of grief, at least from a PR standpoint, if not actual grief of loss. What could the escalation look like in this case, and how much do you trust the current general in charge over there, U.S. general?
That is a tough question, and I have to tell you that if you look at the theory of escalation and deterrence, they all assume what we call the rational actor. And so they're very sophisticated models of how escalation can happen and how deterrence works and how you deter somebody. I am not at all sure that we're dealing with rational actors on the U.S. side. So it is extremely hard for me to predict what the U.S. might or might not do. I'll give you an example. I don't think threatening North Korea with aircraft carrier strike groups makes any kind of military sense whatsoever, yet they did it. So I really cannot predict. I mean, I have to just admit my total incompetence and say I don't know what the Americans would do. I have a clear opinion what the Russians would do. And if you want, I can tell you what I think the Russian reply would be to any military escalation killing Russians. I can look into. But Americans, honestly, I don't have the skill set to predict what they could do.
All right, but clearly there's some even just around Syria, let alone what you just mentioned, which is, yes, it's very odd to use carrier groups against a nation like is well-armed with things like howitzers and whatnot. It's North Korea. But
exactly.
But looking at the U.S., we clearly have goals that are in total conflict with each other, and stated goals, and none of them really actually make sense. So as we look into that side of things, yeah, tell us, what do you think the Russian response would be?
They would shoot back. That's why I was so afraid of Hillary. That's the thing. I think the U.S. is wants to play what I call a game of nuclear chicken to see if they can make the Russians blink. And they were successful in doing that. And that's the big problem with Russia, is that the Russians did blink over and over and over and over, particularly during the 90s. Then when Putin came to power, it became more complicated. The Russians showed caution, but sometimes they also showed a great deal of determination, like in Georgia, where there was a possibility of U.S. intervention, and the Russians knew that. Same thing with Crimea. The Russians knew that there could be a possibility. This time, I think they would have to absolutely shoot back, because the first thing that would happen if a case of a U.S. major escalation of whatever kind, it would be very hard to separate the Russians from the Syrians, from the Iranians, from Hezbollah. It would become sort of a binary us and them kind of thing, and you don't know who's doing what. So even if the United States decided to declare we're not targeting Russians, they would be. And even if they weren't, the Russians would still take action, because the Russians are not going to let the government forces be overrun by a combination of al-Qaeda on the ground and the U.S. in the air. So they would fight, as would the Iranians. They would fight very hard. So I think what would happen is that you would essentially have Americans and Russians shooting at each other, with a very serious potential of, because next question is, do the Americans try to hit Russians elsewhere to even prevent them from resupplying? And I think if you read the mood in Congress, it's definitely an option. They might try to push for that kind of stuff. They have been doing it already with threats to check for ships, even in Pacific ports, including Russian ports, for stuff that violates U.S. imposed embargoes. So I would see an action like that would be met by force by Russia for sure. So the problem is with Russia, the Russians have retreated pretty much as far as they can. They have no more space to retreat. So the only real question left in my mind is, do Americans realize that? And do they understand the consequences of trying to push them further? Or they're going to go, okay, we've pushed them as far as we can possibly do without triggering something truly scary, and at which point we have to stop. And stop means to negotiate. That is the real issue. And I'm not at all, I don't trust that government in the U.S. whatsoever. I have a very bad opinion of Mattis. And I don't think that I'm not at all encouraged. I was encouraged by Flynn. He was pretty bad on Iran, but I had hopes that this was just empty rhetoric to get himself in the right position in the White House. But at least he understood that any rational analysis tells you Russia and the United States should collaborate together against their common enemy. And I don't think that's the agenda today in certainly not in Congress.
Well,
so I'm frightened. I really am again.
To hark back to something you said earlier, I was not a gigantic Trump supporter, but I was very much a single issue voter this last time, which was I was saying no to nuclear war, which I consider to be
same here, exact same.
Yep, I think that would be very bad for business and my life and the future. That's just a view I hold. But it seems to me, and I don't understand why, and I'm just as clueless as anybody, I do not understand why there are people in the United States, the neocons, are so desperately seeking perpetual, if not larger, conflict with Russia, when everything that I analyze says that we should be way more on the friend side than enemy side, given how the interests stack up at this particular time in history. And maybe counterproductively or maybe intentionally, it looks to me like Putin and China under President Xi are certainly getting closer and closer around all of this. And so for the United States to be poking China on one side over the Spratlys and maybe Taiwan and arms sales, and then Russia on the other side, it feels a little nutty to me. It feels a little nuts. I don't understand it.
It is completely nuts, and it's due to the fact I'm convinced that the neocons are absolutely not American patriots. They couldn't care less about the United States. They have their ideology, they have their agenda, and they're just, you know, like parasites sitting in the United States and using that country for their own petty ideological interests, which is the same thing what the Saudis are doing, by the way. So it's a country that's been hijacked, and that is the real problem, because I think patriotically, and by patriot, I mean simply some person who loves this country. That's all I mean by that term. Patriotic Americans would immediately see the obvious thing that Russia and the United States have no conflict. Inherent conflict. There's nothing to fight over, and there's a great deal to work together with. But this is something that the neocons do not want, and that's why they basically crushed Trump. That's why they don't let, in both in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, all those people who are for a non-aggressive foreign policy, be it Ron Paul or Kucinich, are never let. The party system doesn't let them, get anywhere near power, or Congress, as a matter of fact. So if you look at the Republican and Democratic National Committees, they always take away money, even if it means losing the seat, from pro-peace candidates. There is a real problem here in the United States, and that problem could end up with an international nuclear war. And I agree with you. I mean, my pro-Trump, it wasn't because I think the guy is good-looking or particularly intelligent or I care about his other issues. It was one thing only. I don't want this country to enter in a war with Russia, and that's what Hillary was promising us. So I didn't vote. I don't have U.S. citizenship. But if I had U.S. citizenship, I would have voted for him just on that single issue. And I think that the tragedy here in the United States is that people are never told that war is a possibility. Every time I mention that, I get a lot of comments saying, "Well, you're crazy. We're as far away from war as ever." No, we're not. And if you look at Russian TV, which I follow every day, and the Russian media, they discuss that on a weekly basis. Russia has large-scale exercises, including in the banking sector, how to operate in case of war. Civil defense has been constantly preparing for war. The military districts are preparing for war. I mean, Russia has been preparing for war for the past 2 years. And I've been trying to sound the alarm with other people, like Dmitry Orlov, trying to say, careful, guys, because we are following what's happening in Russia. And these guys are not doing that just because they feel like doing it. They're doing that because truly they believe that war is a possibility, and so do I. And that is why the media here is basically covering everything except that one topic, because they don't want the people here to realize that takeover of the United States by the neocons is something that can end up costing our entire civilization. That's how bad it is, and we're risking that.
I only saw one, what I would call mainstream editorial, that was in The Week, not that long ago, the magazine The Week, where they had an editorial about that idea, which is, hey, this could end a nuclear war, and that would be very bad, we can all agree. But otherwise, you're right, it's been chirping crickets. So as we come into the close here, though, I'm really fascinated, if you could, who do you read? Which sites or news outlets do you regularly visit to gather your information? So if people are interested in beginning to gather sort of their own source views, where do you go?
To be truly honest, most of my sources now are people that I have contacts in the various countries that I follow. And that's directly sent me emails. We sort of had this informal going on conversation by video conference or by email with a lot of people. I do not follow the mainstream media whatsoever because I mean, this is a mixture of propaganda and entertainment. So I have no respect or interest for it. Blogs, the free media, depending on the topic. I mean, I don't have the one source that I would go to get my news. Mm-hmm. On the website, I list, but it's mostly focused on Russia, so it's partially, there's, for instance, nothing on Syria, I list English language news sources that I think are doing a good job on Russia. There are a bunch of sites that I call Brothers in Arms that are basically trying to do the same thing as I try to do about the Russian reality. And sort of I pick and choose of what I can see, but it's all internet-based. I have no TV, no radio. I don't read the newspapers. I mean, the mainstream media has no interest for me whatsoever.
Well, we're very similar in that way. And this has been an absolutely fascinating, entertaining, and if I can use that word, but also really informative discussion. Thank you, Saker, for your time today. Really a huge honor to have you on. Please tell people how they can follow your excellent work more closely again, and if there's any other books or publications that you would like to direct them to.
You can look at my website. It's called thesaker, in one word, .is, stands for Iceland. That's where we have our service there. And you can get my book on my website. It's called The Essential Saker. I'm actually working on a second one right now, but this one will come out, I guess, later this year or early next year. And if you look at the top of the page, I have something called the Saker Community. There are Saker blogs in French, Russian, Italian, one in Spanish for Latin America, and one even for New Zealand and Oceania, Australia, so and Serbia. So in different languages, you can also look at those. They're very good, and they're independent, so you get more from them to just on my website.
Fantastic.
And thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Well, the honor's mine. All the best with your upcoming book. Thank you so much again for your time today.
You're more than welcome.